This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
Impeachment, said George Mason, one of the signers of the Constitution. George Mason, he says, impeachment should be reserved for treason, bribery, and high crimes and misdemeanors where the president's actions are great and dangerous offenses or attempts to subvert the Constitution. And the most extensive injustice. Greetings, my friends. Welcome to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. You can drop by our live chat room, TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com. Click the Tom Hartman link. It'll take you to our page where there's a link to our live chat room as well. And our telephone number, 866-303-2270. In the second hour of our program, we're going to be talking with Liz Holtzman, the former Democratic Congresswoman from New York and co-author of the book, The Impeachment of George W. Bush, A Practical Guide for Concerned Citizens. Harvey Wasserman will be with us here in our third hour, the Free Press senior editor, very involved in the investigations of the theft of the 2004 election in Ohio. He's also written a new book about solar power, which should be interesting. Larry Scott with VAWatchdog.org be with us in our third hour. But I want to start out the program today by taking with an overview, kind of a big picture thing, an overview of what is the end game here. What are going to be the final consequences of this 26-year conservative war on the middle class, the American middle class? Keeping in mind that the conservative philosophy, and conservatives make no bones about it. Oh, by the way, today, 600 days, 12 hours, 47 minutes, 34 seconds, until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily. 600 days, assuming there's no impeachment. Back to the point here. The conservative worldview, by and large, and you go back and read Russell Kirk's book in 1953, The Conservative Mind. Read the writings of William F. Buckley. Go all the way back to Sir Edmund Burke in the 1790s. Go all the way back to Thomas Hobbes in the 1630s. I mean, the conservative worldview, or for that matter, many contemporary conservatives, or simply look at their behaviors. The conservative worldview is that small d democracy is really a dangerous thing. Our first conservative president, John Adams, the second president of the United States, really the only conservative president among the first five, strongly and forcefully argued that the rabble, that would be you and me, should have the feeling that they're participating in democracy, but really their participation should be minimized because the rabble you can't trust. And so what happens is you end up with, when conservatives are in control of government, which they ultimately don't believe in beyond having its defensive capacity or its punishing capacity, in other words, police and armies, they'll go along with that. But when conservatives end up in control of anything else, any other branch of government, they view it as, well, here's an opportunity to help out my friends, here's an opportunity to get rich, here's an opportunity to, because they don't think that there's any other purpose, there's any purpose for it to begin with, but the people are demanding that it continue to exist, so why not, use it to build up those institutions that they think are actually one of the ways that you measure the quality of a society. Conservatives believe that the quality of society is a measurement, is measured by the power of its institutions and its wealthy people. Is there a strong aristocracy? Look at history. History is the history basically of rich people, of kings and queens and the traditional liberal values of America, on the other hand, starting with George Washington, starting with the Declaration of Independence, actually, before Washington was president. The liberal history of America is essentially contradicts that. The liberal values of America on which this country was founded contradict that. That really the purpose of government is not to just restrain people from acting out their evil impulses, but rather the purpose of government is to help elevate people, to give people an opportunity, all of us, as many people as possible, an opportunity not just to participate in government and governance, but also to reach our highest potential, to achieve our highest potential. But you see increasingly, you know, right across the board, you see these examples of how conservatives are essentially kind of screwing things up. And why? You know, because this is their ideology. For example, New York Times today reporting about the governor of Nevada, the Republican governor, Jim Gibbons. If this wasn't from the New York Times, you'd think it was from Andy Borowitz. In the last few months, Mr. Gibbons, a Republican, announced a plan to turn coal into jet fuel to raise money, problematic as Nevada has no coal to speak of, and proposed paying for a $3.8 billion shortfall in highway construction funds by selling water rights under state highways. It turns out the state does not actually own the rights. He told the local editorial board he could not pronounce the name of his energy advisor because she was Indian, she is Turkish, and vetoed a bill that would stop budget-busting tax breaks for builders of green buildings before issuing an executive order to end them anyway, with the exception of four companies. He's the subject of the Republican governor of Nevada. I mean, this is just, you know, here we go again. He's the subject of an FBI inquiry into whether he failed to report gifts from a military contractor while serving in Congress. He won't be interviewed by the New York Times. He's denying wrongdoing, but once suggested that Democratic operatives might have paid off newspaper reporters who have written about his troubles with the FBI. Yeah, right. This is the guy who said during his campaign for governor, and I quote, liberal, tree-hugging, Birkenstock-wearing, hippie, tie-dyed liberals, end of quote, should be used as human shields in Iraq. You get it? So this broad belief that, you know, really there should be an aristocracy. There should be a conservative aristocracy running the country. It really and truly does go all the way back to the founding of our nation. Alexander Hamilton, one of our early conservatives, in the opening, literally the opening day of the Constitutional Convention, getting up and giving a speech in which he said the British form of government is the finest form of government that has ever been created, and I'm paraphrasing wildly here, but this is the essence of what he said, and we should recreate it here. He was arguing in favor of the president being elected for life. We should create it here, only instead of the presidency being passed from father to son to grandson, it should be passed from the most competent person for life to the next most competent person by an electoral process. In other words, we should have a meritocracy rather than but it should nonetheless be an aristocracy. Which brings us to Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney, he says, this is from the Associated Press today, Mitt Romney said yesterday, he would likely donate his salary to charity if elected president. Isn't that nice? Being rich enough to just... his assets are worth... He's roughly worth $250 million. He's the wealthiest of all the candidates, Democrat or Republican. He was at a town hall in New Hampshire. At the Liberty Mutual office in Dover, New Hampshire, and he was asked if millionaire candidates could resolve government problems in Washington. And so the way he's going to resolve government problems, he's not going to take a salary. Oh, gee, we've saved $200,000. Isn't that nice? Meanwhile, look at the consequences of Republican policies or of conservative policies. There, you know, Bill Clinton went along with these in some cases, the international policies, not so much the domestic policies. But the trade deficit, for example. In 2001, when George W. Bush came into office, when he was installed by the Supreme Court, we were accumulating a trade deficit, that is, buying more stuff from the rest of the world than we sell to them. That is, other countries ending up with our dollars that they're going to use to do what? Come here and buy our companies and our land. We had a trade deficit of $690,000 a minute. Oh, there goes another. By 2002, it was up to $800,000 a minute. By 2003, it was at $942,000 a minute. By 2004, it was over $1 million a minute, 1.2. By 2005, it was $1.4 million a minute. Now it's $1,450,000 a minute. That's a trade deficit of $765 billion. And Mitt Romney says, I've created thousands and thousands of jobs. Well, when Ted Kennedy ran against him, he ran some ads of Mitt Romney's former employees.
SCM. Mitt Romney's firm bought the company and fired all 350 workers. Now some former workers talk about Romney's business practices.
He's cut our wages to put money in back into his pocket.
You're not creating jobs, you're taking them away from us to put money in your pocket.
He just wants to take money out of your pocket
right.
and put it in his.
I'd like to say to the people of Massachusetts that you think it can't happen to you, think again, because we thought it wouldn't happen here either.
Indeed. That's Mitt Romney. Oh, very competent businessman. He's worth $250 million. How did he get that money? Well, he bought a company, laid off all the workers, shipped the jobs overseas. Yeah. He says he's created 10,000 jobs. Maybe in China. Maybe in China. So the conservative war on the American middle class. Is it possible that we can turn this thing around? Can we wake up enough people quickly enough? I think we can. I'll tell you about how right after this. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
So what are going to be the final consequences of the war on the middle class? How can we roll this thing back? I mean, it's been going on for 26 years, ever since Ronald Reagan first declared war on the middle class in 1981, busting up PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, declaring war on unionized workers. Reagan came into office, a quarter of America's workforce was unionized, 25%. Now we're down to about 7% of the private workforce of the United States. Unionized. The beginning of this very aggressive war in the middle class. What got me started on this thing? Well, actually, let me give you the answer before I continue. I believe that the answer is waking people up to the fact that there is a political process that actually does impact their economic lives. One of the great lies that's been perpetrated by cons for the last 26 years. In both the Republican and Democratic Party, you'll find conservatives. They, you know, virtually the entire Republican Party and a small but sizable minority of the Democratic Party, these so-called DLC Democrats, these economic conservatives. And what they've been saying, what they've been suggesting ever since Reagan is that if economic stuff happens, you know, like the old bumper sticker, that it's, you know, it kind of falls out of the sky. It has nothing to do with any decisions that are being made in Washington, D.C. It's just the natural order of things. It's the olive tree versus the Lexus. It's because the world is flat now, didn't you know? Just ask Tom Friedman. He'll tell you all about it. But the fact of the matter is that it really is the consequence of policies being made in Washington, D.C. And when we wake enough people up to the fact that their own personal economic future is tied to decisions being made in Washington, D.C. and in state capitals around the country, and get them active and involved in political activity and politics in general, then, you know, I think that there's a good chance that we can move this country forward in a positive direction. But it's not the way that we're moving right now. What got me started on this, really ripping on this thing, was this piece in the Associated Press. The headline, American men make 12.5% less than their fathers 30 years ago, report on mobility says. The part of the American dream that says a man's children will be better off than he was has become a dream, not a reality, according to an analysis of Census Department data released Friday. A generation ago, American men in their 30s had median annual incomes of about $40,000, compared with men of the same age who now make about $35,000 a year adjusted for inflation. That's a 12.5% drop between 1974 and 2004. Now, household incomes have risen. You will hear conservatives come on this program all the time, and they'll say, the average American household is making more money than they were in 1974. Yeah, why? Because you've got two people working. Household incomes rose because there are more full-time working women. Today's data suggests that during a 30-year period of economic expansion, a rising tide did not lift all boats, says one of the authors, John Morton, of this report. Economic mobility is the American dream alive and well, is the title of the report with a rhetorical question. It says, of course, the men who run America's companies don't have too much to complain about. CEO pay increased to 262 times the average worker's pay in 2005 from only 35 times the average worker's pay in 1978. Gee, surprise, surprise. And our media is getting into the act. CNN has hired a new reporter. Isn't this cool? Hey, they're adding to their reporting staff. An entertainment reporter who's just going to be reporting on Michael Jackson and Britney Spears. Yeah. Meanwhile, Mitt Romney, it just, you know, and this isn't, frankly, to pick on Mitt Romney. I'm, you know, my prediction is that Chuck Hagel is going to end up being the Republican nominee, although I think Romney has a good chance of being it. But, you know, Mitt Romney, a guy who's worth $250 million, $250 million, much of that money coming from buying up companies, laying off their employees, milking it dry, and sticking the money in his checking account. This is from an ad when Romney ran against Ted Kennedy for the Senate. This is from an ad, from a Kennedy ad, where they went back and they talked to some of Romney's former employees.
I'd like for him to show me where these 10,000 jobs that he's created are.
I don't think Romney's creating jobs because he took every one of them away.
I'd worked there 30 years. And I never dreamed that I'd lose my job.
Mitt Romney says he helped create 10,000 jobs. The former workers at SCM in Marion, Indiana, say something else.
If he's created jobs, I wish he could create some here, you know, instead of taking them away.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure he did create jobs in China or Mexico or Malaysia or someplace like that. I mean, there's what George Bush said he was going to do. He's going to create millions of jobs, and he did, you know, in China and India, Mexico. In the meantime, our Pentagon contractors, they've seen their stocks on average triple since the beginning of the war in Iraq. We're seeing this huge shift of wealth and income from the American middle class to the very wealthy, from working people to people who don't work for a living but sit around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive in the mail or move money around for a living. At the same time, the country is going deeper and deeper and deeper in debt. We need to help wake people up all across America as to what the real conservative agenda here is, which is destroying the middle class because it's unstable. I'll explain that right after this and take your calls in just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
In fact, I would submit to you, welcome back, brother, 34 minutes past the hour, I would submit to you that one of the few things that's actually holding this economy together, tragically, is the war in Iraq. And that's because so much money is being spent that it's you know, some of it is working its way back into the United States, going to U.S. military contractors. We're talking at $141.7 billion. This from Global Research, by the way, globalresearch.ca. $141.7 billion. This year's proposed spending on the Iraq war is larger than the military budgets of China and Russia combined. The entire military budgets. Just what we're spending on in Iraq. Today, total U.S. military spending for fiscal year 2008 is roughly 10 times the military budget of the second largest military spending country in the world, which is China. Our military budget is 30 times higher than all spending on State Department operations and non-military foreign aid combined. The 2008 military budget represents 58 cents out of every dollar spent by the U.S. government on discretionary programs, education, health, housing assistance, international affairs, natural resources, environment, justice, veterans benefits, science and space, transportation. And by the way, this is not the real national defense budget, because it doesn't include a whole bunch of things. This half a trillion dollars roughly a year that we're spending on the Pentagon, we say, well, that's the defense budget, $500 billion a year. But it doesn't include nuclear weapons testing and development. That's in the Energy Department budget. Doesn't include storage of nuclear weapons and waste material associated with it. That's in the Energy Department budget. Doesn't include veterans programs. That's in the VA budget. Doesn't include military retirees payments. That's in the Treasury Department's budget. Doesn't include foreign military aid in the form of weapons grants to allies, which is, you know, a big part of our military. That's in the State Department's budget. Doesn't include interest payments on money borrowed to fund programs in the military in past years. That's in the Treasury Department's budget. Doesn't include sales and property taxes at military bases. That shows up in the budgets of local governments and state governments. And then there's all the hidden expenses of tax-free food, housing, combat pay allowances, all that. None of that stuff shows up in the Treasury, in the Defense Department budget. It's huge. And here's the incredible shift that has happened. In 1984, almost two-thirds of the contracting budget, this is the Defense Department budget passing money out to private corporations. About two-thirds of that was for products. In other words, the government, the military, was buying things. They were buying, you know, those famous toilet seats or keyboards or computers or whatever. But now, about 56% of the Defense Department contracts are for services. What are we buying? We're buying soldiers, mercenaries, 100,000 government contractors operating in Iraq. As Scott Shane and Ron Nixon wrote in the New York Times recently, without a public debate or formal policy decision, contractors have become a virtual fourth branch of government. Spending on federal contracts has soared during the Bush administration to about $400 billion last year. That's more than twice what, or almost twice what it was when Bush came into office, which was in and of itself pretty startling. So how are we paying for this? Well, a total of 141 different government programs are going to be eliminated or sharply reduced, including housing assistance for low-income seniors being cut by a quarter, home heat energy assistance to low-income people being cut by 18%, funding for community development grants cut by 12.7%, grants for education, employment training cut by 8%. Oh, but $1.6 trillion, that's $1,600 billion over the next 10 years, is going to be set aside as tax cuts, permanent tax cuts, at least if Bush has his way, for people who make $1 million a year and more. Meanwhile, funding for domestic discretionary programs is going to be cut a total of $114 billion. So, you know, we have tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires, run our country into debt in the process, and in the meantime, our country is being sold off. This from economyandcrisis.org. America's losing control of its economy is now quietly being taken over by foreign countries through their purchase and control of our strategic industries. TV manufacturing, 100% now foreign-owned. Sound recording industry, 97% foreign-owned. Movie industry, 75% foreign-owned. Metal ore industry, 65% owned. They're taking our ore out of the ground, shipping it over to other countries, turning it into TV sets and selling it back to us. Book publishing, 63% foreign-owned. Cement industry, 81% foreign-owned. Oh, look at that. We're building a building here. It's America at work. No, I'm sorry. It's France or England or China or Japan at work in America. Why? Because once we did away with tariffs and went to this Kool-Aid-drinking, insane so-called free trade model, American workers have to compete with Chinese workers, and it just doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. Mark in Los Angeles, if you want to disagree with me, you go to the front of the line. What's up?
Hello.
Hey, Mark.
Yes, I disagree with the fact that the war in Iraq could help this economy keep going, because I think that the fundamentals of an economy is not based on the actions of our government or the actions of foreign governments or even the actions of corporations who hire people, but it is based upon the hopes and the psychology of the people in this economy, the consumer. Now, this war has driven people's hopes and fears. And I think the hopes and fears of the American people are the ones who is what has directly kept this economy going now, and that will be what keeps the economy going in the future. First of all,
the economy, you could argue that the economy is not really going, because we're seeing real growth rates, both in terms of employment and wages, you know, just base and the economy itself, at about half of what it was during the Clinton administration. But I would go beyond that. I would say that the extent to which we are not in a full-blown recession that is like bordering on a depression is because 500 billion dollars has been spent over the last 5 years on the war in Iraq, and the Bush administration has figured out a way to have most of that money cycled back into the United States. Now, over the short term, that's a stimulating thing to an economy. If Halliburton is making money, their stock goes up, you know, they're paying dividends, they're buying, they're sourcing things in the United States. If Boeing is making money, if Grumman is making money, if General Electric is making money, if all the big defense contractors are making money and their stock is going up, that does stimulate our economy short term. The problem is, if you decide to stimulate an economy with government spending, which there's a long history of in this country and actually does work, it's how Roosevelt got us out of the Great Depression with the WPA and the CCC and things like that. If you do that, building infrastructure inside our country, which is what Roosevelt did, if you build highways, if you build dams, if you build or power generating systems, today it would be dams, it would be windmills or solar panels systems, but if you build infrastructure, build schools, you build those things that over time are going to generate jobs and they're going to add to the economy, then you're going to build a strong nation. Over the short term, you're going to have incredible and measurable stimulation of the economy, and over the long term, you're going to have a stronger nation and a stronger economy. But if you spend the exact same amount of money, and Bush is spending, you know, money that's not that dissimilar to what Roosevelt was spending in 33 and 34 and 35 with the WPA and CCC, he's spending in Iraq right now. If you spend the same amount of money on a war, the problem is, after the money is spent and put in the pockets of, say, Halliburton, and Halliburton decides that they're going to move to Dubai. Well, it even goes beyond that. Once that money is spent, it doesn't generate more money. If you build a huge electric generating system, you know, like building the Hoover Dam, instead of the Hoover Dam, you know, say, okay, we've dammed up enough rivers, let's build the Hoover wind system across the United States, or the Hoover solar system across the United States. That's going to generate jobs and electricity and resources for years and years to come. If you build a whole bunch of bombs and you drop them in Iraq, there's the short-term stimulus of the paying the people who built the bombs and mining the copper and the lead and all that kind of stuff and making the dynamite and whatnot and all that. There's the short-term stimulus of that spending. But once that bomb has been dropped, that money is gone. The vast majority of the $500 billion that Bush is spending on this war is not going to end up building an economy over the long term. It's just recycling back into the economy in a really fast way. And that's, you know, that's the tragedy of this whole thing. That's the huge tragedy of this thing. Mark in Houston. Hey, Mark, got to take a break in about a minute. Quick one.
Well, the problem with this whole corporate economy thing is that it kind of exists to take money from many people and you know, concentrate it in the hands of the few, whereas
exactly
business would be more better served to take take revenues and spread them out over large numbers of people who can circulate that money and keep it going, you know, keep employed, keep purchasing goods, keep taking trips, keep
But we have a model now where the most effective way to make a profit is to do what Mitt Romney did, which is to buy up a company, lay off all their employees, and then shift their manufacturing overseas. Until we change our trade policies and our economic policies, that it's going to continue to be that way. That's why we can't afford somebody like Mitt Romney.
I've seen is when a company is driven to the point where it has to take some kind of action, typically the first thing they do is they lay off all the people who work for that company and who make that company's money.
That's absolutely right. And give that money to the CEOs. Yeah, no, I got it, Mark. And it's not good for the economy. You know, yeah, it's good for the few conservative rich, but not good for the economy. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Now, at the same time that America is being bankrupted by these conservative economic policies, so is the average American family. And, you know, one of the instruments of this has been the whole refi thing. This on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, an article titled Day of Reckoning. This is the first in a series, Inside the Subprime Mortgage Debacle, the Debt Bomb. Mark Whitehouse writing for the Wall Street Journal. He says, over the past several years, seven of the 26 households in the 5001 block, he's looking at a particular block of a particular street, West Outer Drive in Detroit, a middle-class neighborhood, kind of, you know, Beaver Cleaver Country, USA. Over the past several years, seven of the 26 households in the 5100 block have taken out subprime loans. Most already owned their homes and used the proceeds to pay off credit cards, do renovations, and maintain an appearance of middle-class fortitude amid a declining local economy. This is a drama that's playing out in middle and lower-income, often minority-dominated communities across the country. He adds, subprime mortgages and the brokers who peddle them are helping to take families out of homes in which they've lived for years, eroding the benefits the proponents on Wall Street and in Congress have long touted. In 2006 alone, of course, for example, according to an analysis from First American Loan Performance, subprime investors from all over the world injected more than $1 billion into 22 zip codes in Detroit, where home values were falling, unemployment was rising, and the foreclosure rate was already the nation's highest. By some estimates, subprime lending has accounted for as much as half of the past decade's rise in the U.S. home ownership rate to 69% from 65%. But this flood of cash has also encouraged people to get into financially precarious positions, often precisely at the time when they're least able to afford to do it. Diane Swank, an analyst who spent 19 years looking at this, she says, the market was feeding an addict at its neediest point. And they just, in this article, it's a fascinating article in today's Wall Street Journal, and they just go through and they just tell the stories, person after person after person, these people who are basically losing their homes because they signed up for these adjustable rate mortgages, and boom, the rate went up, and they didn't have the money. They just got nailed. I mean, it's just, you know, no other way to describe it. Mr. Dixon defaulted on the loan after the monthly payment jumped to more than $1,500 from $1,142. Ms. Moore has fallen behind in the monthly mortgage payments, which she says rose this year to $2,200 a month from about $1,450. At what point should the government be saying, hey, wait a minute, we have usury laws. This used to be illegal, a lot of this stuff. So it's pretty mind-boggling. Len in New York City. Hey, Len.
Hi, Tom. You know, the war on the middle class is a class war. And you there? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, Warren Buffett put it best. He's the second richest guy, and he said, you know, there's definitely class warfare, and the rich class are winning.
Yeah.
And, you know, public financing of elections is probably the rudimentary only solution that's going to ever resolve this. But while I got the opportunity to speak, I just wanted to let you know, it was only a week and a half or 2 weeks ago that I actually went for the first time to this website, Loose Change 9/11. You must be familiar with it, right?
I am, yeah.
And I think, you know, for months now, or almost a year, I was wondering why after so far after 9/11 is the percentage of the people in this country still rising that thinks that Bush had something to do with it or knew about it in advance. I mean, I said to myself, that percentage should have leveled off already.
And yeah, well, you know, the same thing happened after the Kennedy assassination, that over time, you know, people start going, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't seem right. There's something wrong here. And there's definitely something wrong here with regard to 9/11. In fact, there's a whole bunch of things wrong there. And the biggest thing that's wrong is that there's never been a competent investigation. But I, you know, I don't want to go off on that topic. We have done that topic. We've had David Gregory Griffin and others on the program in the past, and we'll come back to that topic. But right now, I'd like to stick to our debt problem. Cheryl in Torrance, California. Hey, Cheryl.
Hi, Tom. Great talking to you.
You know,
I'm tired of hearing that America is one of the greatest, wealthiest countries in the world when in the actuality of it, we are, China actually owns us and other countries do as well. And
we are the most indebted nation in the world today. When Reagan came into office, we were the richest nation in the world and we were the largest creditor in the world. And today we are the poorest nation in the world and the largest debtor in the world.
Yeah, but you don't hear that constantly. You constantly hear we're the richest nation in the world. Now, my point is this. the outsourcing of those multiple jobs that Bush has so well done is a way of appeasing some of that bill. Don't you think that by giving China and a lot of these other countries some of our biggest commodities to build, yes, it's cheaper, but don't you think he made a deal with the devil just to appease some of that bill so they don't start demanding payment at ASAP?
Yeah, it may well be. It may well be. But you have to be really careful of confusing cause and effect. I mean, the reason why China owns us, by the way, I said we're the poorest country. We're not the poorest country in the world. We're the most indebted country in the world.
Right.
But the reason why China owns us is because we have handed it over to them. We've said, okay, you guys, you can, you know, we'll do all our manufacturing over there. I mean, this is, and it's wrong. Nora in Minneapolis. Hey, Nora.
Oh, hey, Tom. I was calling. It was a little bit of a different subject, although I did have experience with that foreclosure problem where they tried to offer me stuff, and it was so suspicious what they're offering. My question about that is, do these people where their payments go up to $1,500, did they not ever be forewarned or not understand or explain that?
No, read the Wall Street Journal article. What you get is that over and over and over again, it's the same story, that they were told, well, you know, the adjustable rate mortgage will trigger in 2 years, and 2 years is a long time, and during that period of time, you'll probably have an opportunity to refinance at a fixed rate. And so don't worry about it. And then when they try and go out and refinance at a fixed rate, they find out that, you know, hey, the credit market's getting a little tighter these days, unless you want to get another, you know, variable rate note, then let's put it off another 2 years into the distance, because the people who are selling these things are making an average $5,000 commission as opposed to a $3,000 commission on a normal bank loan, according to the Wall Street Journal today. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
So who should we impeach first? And how do we do it? Should it be Gonzalez? Should it be Cheney? Should it be Bush? Should it be Condi Rice for not paying any attention before 9/11? Or perhaps paying too much attention to the wrong things? Or whatever. Liz Holtzman has some experience in this area. She's the former Democratic Congresswoman from New York and the co-author of The Impeachment of George W. Bush, A Practical Guide for Concerned Citizens. You can find it on the web at impeachbushbook.com. And Liz Holtzman, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you.
Thanks, and great to have you back on our program. The Gonzalez Resignation Watch, how does this tie into all of this whole panoply of issues that have to do with the question of, is it malfeasance, is it incompetence, is it simply this is how conservatives govern, et cetera? Well, let's start out with Gonzalez. What's going on with Gonzo in your mind?
Well, of course, you know, Gonzalez was an aider and abettor in a number of actions that were could have been illegal at the time, may still be illegal. For example, Gonzalez was involved in the wiretap orders. That's a felony to violate the federal Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which President Bush signed wiretap orders that did not follow what the statute said, which is you have to get a court order. In fact, Gonzalez and the president went ahead and issued a directive to continue the wiretapping, even in the face of the Justice Department statement. This is Ashcroft, Comey, Mueller, and the head of the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department saying that to do so would be illegal. If we start with Mr. Gonzalez, it's a pretty nefarious role as a facilitator for acts that certainly are abuses of power and quite possibly illegal. Not only that, but Gonzalez was the one who wrote the memo to the president urging that the president sidestep the Geneva Conventions and therefore avoid the imposition of criminal liability under the War Crimes Act, facilitating torture and mistreatment of detainees could be a U.S. crime and certainly a violation of the Geneva Convention. So Mr. Gonzalez has a pretty spotty record, to be kind. But the real question is President Bush going to let him go? And I wrote an article that was published in the Los Angeles Times recently suggesting that they would do everything in their power to keep Gonzalez on.
Because he knows where the bodies are buried.
That could be part of it. I don't know that Gonzalez is going to be too eager to talk because he just incriminates himself.
Well,
but the problem is that if you go back to Watergate, what brought President Nixon down? There were a number of different things, not too many, but one of the key factors was that there was a special prosecutor who was appointed to look at Watergate, the criminality involved. That was Archibald Cox. And
right.
That came about when there was a vacancy in the Attorney General's job. Richard Kleindienst had resigned because of his involvement with Watergate-related matters, and the President Nixon wanted to appoint a successor, and he appointed Elliot Richardson, and the U.S. Senate said, you know, Mr. Richardson, you're a very nice fellow, you're very qualified, you're a very capable guy, but we're not going to confirm you unless you agree to appoint a special prosecutor to look at Watergate. And that's how we got a special prosecutor in Watergate, and that was how the whole edifice came crumbling down. And the last thing you know that President Bush wants, or anybody in that administration wants, is a special prosecutor looking at the U.S. attorney scandal or looking at other scandals and potential criminality, including the wiretapping and whether you had a violation of federal laws there. So,
now, how is this? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I mean, having been the one thing you didn't mention, Tom, was that I sat on the House Judiciary Committee during the impeachment of Richard Nixon.
Yes.
So some of these facts, you know, just get embedded in your head from past history, but past history has a way of repeating itself.
Is there still legislative authority for a special prosecutor?
Yes.
And how is a special prosecutor different from whatever Ken Starr was, which is somehow qualitatively different, and I don't think still has statutory authority?
Right. Attorney General has the power to appoint a special prosecutor if he is or she is conflicted out. That power always existed. What was created in light of what happened during Watergate, because it was only by accident that there was a vacancy in the Justice Department, and some of us, including me, said, well, we've got to have a special prosecutor there to investigate crimes of high officials, even if there is an attorney general. So what we did was we created a court-appointed special prosecutor and triggered, basically, if there was a finding that there was it was a very low threshold to trigger the appointment. In other words, unless there was no evidence whatsoever that there was any criminality, you had to go, the attorney general had to go to court and get a court-appointed special prosecutor. The problem was with Kenneth Starr, that the court appointed somebody inappropriate because the court itself, leave it at that, but they appointed somebody who was highly political and created the appearance of partisanship, and the Kenneth Starr himself didn't have the good sense to, in terms of how to handle the investigation. So that was a disaster, and as a consequence, Congress let that statute lapse. And so there is no mechanism aside from having the Attorney General appoint a special prosecutor to get one in there. But the confirmation of a new Attorney General, if Gonzalez resigned, would give the Senate an opportunity to insist on one. And so they don't want that to happen, and they don't want the Senate also to have the opportunity to ask for emails and other things that they can just say, okay, Mr. President, you want your new Attorney General confirmed? Well, we want all the documents, the emails, and the other things that we've been asking for all these years that you've refused to give us. So it puts the president, the White House, in a very, very tough spot to have a confirmation hearing. And so my sense is they will try to avoid that at all costs.
So what should Congress do? I mean, is there without a special prosecutor, you have congressional investigations, I assume, but there's been an enormous amount of stonewalling up to this point, apparently quite successful. You know John Conyers. How far is he going to push this thing? And should there be a groundswell of support for example, impeachment of Gonzalez?
Well, I believe that since Gonzalez has been involved very closely in presidential misconduct that I believe amounts to impeachment, I believe that he would could be found to have committed impeachable offenses. Could Congress do that? It could. That would be a distraction, though, from what I think is more important, which is the effort to investigate and to bring impeachment proceedings against President Bush, because, after all, he's the decider, as he says, and he is the one who is responsible for all of this. It's not just someone whispering nice little things into his ear. He doesn't have to make the decisions that he did, and he did it repeatedly. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I mean, the midnight visit, or whatever you want to call it, that hospital visit,
that James Comey talked about.
That shows that the president, the president was told that the Justice Department found the wiretap program illegal. His own Justice right. Department, not a Democratic Justice Department, not an independent Justice Department, but an American U.S. Republican appointed, his own Attorney General, his own Deputy Attorney General, all the top people, conservative Republicans, found this to be illegal. The president goes right ahead with it. Well, you know, a president who is above the law is a threat to the democracy, and that kind of a president is exactly what the framers had in mind when they provided for impeachment.
And yet, at the same time, we find Democrats in Congress, from Nancy Pelosi on down, holding to this notion that we don't want to be distracted, we want to get things done, although they don't seem to be getting things done. I mean, this recent vote on the Iraq thing, they basically rolled over. How do we wake them up here? We have about a half a minute, by the way, Liz.
Well, I think the American people have to wake up Congress the way the American people woke up Congress during the Nixon impeachment. Let's put the Clinton impeachment aside. Let's go back to what happened during Watergate, when the American people said, enough's enough. We will not have an imperial presidency. We are not a banana republic. We believe in the rule of law, and we believe in the Constitution of the United States, and they forced the Congress to act.
Yeah, although they did it because we had a media that was actually investigating it and publicizing it then, and nowadays that media is pretty much just Air America. So we'll see, we'll see. Liz Holtzman, impeachbushbook.com, the website, her new book, The Impeachment of George W. Bush, A Practical Guide for Concerned Citizens. Liz, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, glad to be with you, Tom.
Thank you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Please impeach me. Let me go. I can't serve you anymore. Thing I can do for you. I'll be your sacrificial lamb.
Okay, we'll take that, George.
Serve me up with mint jelly and a side of ham.
Ew.
And while you're at it, Cheney too.
Yeah, okay.
For once, I'll just tell him what to do.
Please impeach me. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. ABC and CBS did not even report on their morning and evening news shows about James Comey's testimony. This is the guy who is the assistant to the Attorney General. He's the Deputy Attorney General, the number two guy in the Justice Department under John Ashcroft. Ashcroft goes in for pancreatitis and gallbladder surgery. He's in the hospital. His number two guy is now in charge of the Justice Department because Ashcroft has been rendered incompetent. You know, he's sick. He's out of it. He has formally handed power over to this guy. And Comey is being questioned by Chuck Schumer of New York. And he just lays it out. And how this didn't make the evening news just completely boggles my mind. And I think it's really important for us to revisit it.
Okay. Let me go back and take it from the top. You rushed to the hospital that evening. Why?
Now, this is James Comey talking about the hospital in which John Ashcroft is laying gravely ill.
I'm only hesitating because I need to explain why.
Please. I give you all the time you need, sir.
I've actually thought quite a bit over the last 3 years about how I would answer that question if it was ever asked, because I assumed that at some point I would have to testify about it. The one thing I'm not going to do and be very, very careful about is, because this involved a classified program, I'm not going to get anywhere near classified information. I'm also am very leery of and will not reveal the content of advice I gave as a lawyer, deliberations I engaged in. I think it's very important for the Department of Justice that someone who held my position not do that.
Terms of privilege.
Yes, sir.
Understood.
Okay, but that said, let's get
subject
into
to that. I'm uncomfortable talking about this, but I will answer the question. To understand what happened that night, I kind of got to back up about a week.
Please.
In the early part of 2004, the Department of Justice was engaged, the Office of Legal Counsel under my supervision, in a reevaluation both factually and legally of a particular classified program.
Turns out that this was the illegal wiretapping program where Bush is listening to your phone calls and mine, probably the DNC.
And it was a program that was renewed on a regular basis and required signature by the Attorney General certifying to its legality. And I remember the precise date, the program had to be renewed by March the 11th, which was a Thursday of 2004. And we were engaged in a very intensive reevaluation of the matter. And a week before that March 11th deadline, I had a private meeting with the Attorney General for an hour, just the two of us. And I laid out for him what we had learned and what our analysis was of this particular matter. And at the end of that hour-long private session, he and I agreed on a course of action. And within hours, he was stricken and taken very, very ill.
You thought something was wrong with how it was being operated or administered or overseen?
We had concerns as to our ability to certify its legality, and which was our obligation for the program to be renewed. The Attorney General was taken that very afternoon to George Washington Hospital, where he went into intensive care and remained there for over a week, and I became the acting Attorney General. And over the next week, particularly the following week on Tuesday, we communicated to the relevant parties at the White House and elsewhere our decision that, as acting Attorney General, I would not certify the program as to its legality, and explained our reasoning in detail, which I will not go into here, nor am I confirming it's any particular program. That was Tuesday that we communicated that. The next day was Wednesday, March the 10th, the night of the hospital incident. Now
we're up to the hospital incident. So they've basically told Bush, sorry, you can't keep wiretapping Americans. We're not going to sign off on this thing. We've decided it's illegal.
I was headed home at about 8 o'clock that evening. My security detail was driving me. And I remember exactly where I was, on Constitution Avenue, and got a call from Attorney General Ashcroft's chief of staff telling me that he had gotten
What's
a call.
What's his name?
David Ayers. That he had gotten a call from Mrs. Ashcroft from the hospital. She had banned all visitors and all phone calls, so I hadn't seen him or talked to him because he was very ill. And Mrs. Ashcroft reported that a call had come through, and that as a result of that call, Mr. Card and Mr. Gonzalez were on their way to the hospital to see Mr. Ashcroft.
Do you have any idea who that call was from?
I have some recollection that the call was from the president himself, but I don't know that for sure. It came from the White House.
The president himself saying, we're going to send somebody to see Mr. Ashcroft. That's going to be Gonzo and Andrew Card. While Ashcroft is not even the attorney general now, because the guy testifying here, James Comey, the deputy attorney general, is the guy actually in charge. The plot thickens right after this.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
There's no other way to say it. We've been lied to and misled into another senseless war. How many thousands must lay dead before we wake up from this nightmare and revive the American dream? If we blindly stay the course, this horse will drown us in the stream. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our
Indeed. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. So James Comey testifying before Congress, this is several weeks ago. It never got reported on by CBS or ABC. The clips have appeared very rarely on radio, and it's like it just dropped into a hole, and I think it needs to be revisited because, as Liz Holtzman just pointed out, this is evidence that George W. Bush himself is behind, specifically and intentionally, is personally behind, just like Nixon was behind the plumbers and the Watergate thing, is behind this illegal wiretapping operation. Here we have James Comey, the deputy attorney general, the number two guy behind under John Ashcroft. Ashcroft is gravely ill in the hospital. His wife has absolute, nobody is allowed to visit him, orders. Somebody calls the hospital and says to the security detail, you will allow Andrew Card, the chief of staff of the president, and Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney for the president, you will allow these two people to visit with Mr. Ashcroft. Mrs. Ashcroft freaks out and calls James Comey and says that this call just came in, and these guys are going to come, and they're going to see my husband, who is in grave condition. And Comey, who's now the acting attorney general, is freaked out. And then Chuck Schumer says, and who was it who called?
Taylor was driving me, and I remember exactly where I was, on Constitution Avenue, and got a call from Attorney General Ashcroft's chief of staff telling me that he had gotten
What's
a call.
What's his name?
David Ayers. That he had gotten a call from Mrs. Ashcroft from the hospital. She had banned all visitors and all phone calls, so I hadn't seen him or talked to him because he was very ill. And Mrs. Ashcroft reported that a call had come through, and that as a result of that call, Mr. Card and Mr. Gonzalez were on their way to the hospital to see Mr. Ashcroft.
Do you have any idea who that call was from?
I have some recollection that the call was from the president himself, but I don't know that for sure. It came from the White House, and it came through, and the call was taken in the hospital. So I hung up the phone, immediately called my chief of staff, told him to get as many of my people as possible to the hospital immediately. I hung up, called Director Mueller, and
this is the director of the FBI that he called, who works immediately under him as director of the Justice Department. These guys are trying to head off something being done by the President of the United States. Why is the president not being called to testify? Well, because there's no impeachment hearings, because that's the only venue in which Congress can call the president to testify about something like this.
With whom I'd been discussing this particular matter, and who'd been a great help to me over that week, and told him what was happening. He said, I'll meet you at the hospital right now. Told my security detail that I need to get to George Washington Hospital immediately. They turned on the emergency equipment and drove very quickly to the hospital. I got out of the car and literally ran up the stairs with my security detail.
What was your concern? You were in, obviously, a huge hurry.
I was concerned that, given how ill I knew the Attorney General was, that there might be an effort to ask him to overrule me when he was in no condition to do that.
Right.
Okay.
Now, this is basically, in other words, what he's saying is that he believes that Andrew Card and Alberto Gonzalez were going to ask John Ashcroft to sign off on the illegal wiretapping program when he was so stoned on morphine that he had no idea what's going on. After Ashcroft and Comey is the guy who's testifying, the guy who was the acting attorney general, after Ashcroft and Comey had agreed that they were not going to sign off on this thing, it was illegal.
I was worried about him, frankly. And so I raced to the hospital room, entered, and Mrs. Ashcroft was standing by the hospital bed. Mr. Ashcroft was lying down in the bed. The room was darkened. And I immediately began speaking to him, trying to orient him as to time and place and try to see if he could focus on what was happening. And it wasn't clear to me that he could. He seemed pretty bad off.
And at that point, it was you, Mrs. Ashcroft, and the Attorney General and maybe medical personnel in the room. No other Justice Department or government officials.
Just the three of us at that point. I tried to see if I could help him get oriented. As I said, it wasn't clear that I had succeeded. I went out in the hallway, spoke to Director Mueller by phone. He was on his way. I handed the phone to the head of the security detail, and Director Mueller instructed the FBI agents present not to allow me to be removed from the room under any circumstances. And I went back in the room.
Keep in mind, he's now defying the President of the United States, who's sending Andy Card, his chief of staff, and Alberto Gonzalez, his lawyer, down there, and he's saying, He now is this James Comey. He's the acting director of the Justice Department, the head cop in the United States, and he's telling Mueller, the head of the FBI, to tell the FBI guard detail on Ashcroft not to allow him to be thrown out of the office by the president's goons who are on their way.
Shortly joined by the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, Assistant Attorney General Jack Goldsmith, and a senior staffer of mine who had worked on this matter, an associate deputy attorney general. So the three of us, Justice Department people, went in the room. I sat down.
Can you just give us the names of the two other people?
It's Jack Goldsmith, who was the assistant attorney general, and Patrick Philbin, who was associate deputy attorney general. I sat down in an armchair by the head of the attorney general's bed. The two other Justice Department people stood behind me. And Mrs. Ashcroft stood by the bed holding her husband's arm, and we waited. And it was only a matter of minutes that the door opened and in walked Mr. Gonzalez carrying an envelope and Mr. Card. They came over and stood by the bed, greeted the Attorney General very briefly, and then Mr. Gonzalez began to discuss why they were there, to seek his approval for a matter, and explain what the matter was, which I will not do.
And that matter, we now know, was the illegal wiretapping operation where Bush is bugging Democrat, the offices of Democrats all around the country. Who knows who he's bugging? It's still a secret.
And, Attorney General Ashcroft.
What we do know is that Ashcroft and Comey thought it was illegal.
Ashcroft then stunned me. He lifted his head off the pillow and in very strong terms expressed his view of the matter, rich in both substance and fact, which stunned me, drawn from the hour-long meeting we'd had a week earlier, and in very strong terms expressed himself, and then laid his head back down on the pillow, seemed spent, and said to them, but that doesn't matter because I'm not the Attorney General.
But he expressed his reluctance or he would not sign the statement that they give the authorization that they had asked. Is that right?
Yes. And as he laid back down, he said, but that doesn't matter because I'm not the Attorney General. There is the Attorney General. And he pointed to me when I was just to his left. The two men did not acknowledge me. They turned and walked from the room. And within just a few moments after that, Director Mueller arrived. I told him quickly what had happened. He had a brief, memorable, brief exchange with the Attorney General, and then we went outside in the hallway.
Okay. Now, just a few more points on that meeting. First, am I correct that it was Mr. Gonzalez who did just about all of the talking? Mr. Card said very little.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And they made it clear that that there was in this envelope an authorization that they hoped Mr. Ashcroft, Attorney General Ashcroft, would sign.
Yeah, in substance, I don't know exactly the words, but it was clear that's what the envelope was.
And the Attorney General was, what was his condition? I mean, he had pancreatitis. He was very, very ill, in critical condition, in fact.
He was very ill. I don't know how the doctors graded his condition. This would have been his sixth day in intensive care. And as I said, I was shocked when I walked in the room and very concerned as I tried to get him to focus.
Right. Okay, let's continue. What happened after Mr. Gonzalez and Card left? Did you have any contact with them in the next little while?
This is absolutely astounding testimony. This is a couple of weeks old. It never was covered, even reported on by CBS and ABC. NBC covered it in passing. And it so needs to be revisited because this is the evidence. This all began with a phone call from George W. Bush himself to the hospital room to John Ashcroft's wife saying, I'm sending my guys over and you're going to let them in.
While I was talking to Director Mueller, an agent came up to us and said that I had an urgent call in the command center, which was right next door. They had Attorney General Ashcroft in the hallway by himself, and there was an empty room next door. That was the command center, and he said it was Mr. Card wanting to speak to me. I took the call. Mr. Card was very upset and demanded that I come to the White House immediately. I responded that after the conduct I had just witnessed, I would not meet with him without a witness present. He replied, "What conduct? We were just there to wish him well." And I said again, "After what I just witnessed, I will not meet with you without a witness, and I intend that witness to be the Solicitor General of the United States."
That would be Mr. Olson.
Yes, sir. Ted Olson. Until right. I can connect with Mr. Olson, I'm not going to meet with you. He asked whether I was refusing to come to the White House. I said, "No, sir, I'm not. I'll be there. I need to go back to the Department of Justice first." And then I reached out through the command center for Mr. Olson, who was at a dinner party. And Mr. Olson and the other leadership of the Department of Justice immediately went to the department, where we sat down together in a conference room.
Now, this is absolutely incredible. The Department of Justice trying to thwart the President of the United States from committing more illegal acts. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
The call is out across the land, the impeachment of Bush. For crimes and lies, you'd like to see him kicked out on his push. Friends, you've got good reason. I support you absolutely. But this impeachment season, don't forget your civic duty. Impeach Cheney first. It can still get worse. After Bush is in cuffs, it's liable to get rough. Impeach Cheney first.
Yes. Makes a certain amount of sense. I mean, they got Spiro Agnew out of the way. He was more corrupt than Nixon. I think it's because the Republicans knew if Nixon left that Agnew was even worse. So, yeah, it's impeach Cheney. And that was, you know, Dennis Kucinich came up with this idea and proposed it in the House of Representatives. I think, particularly given Comey's testimony, which you just heard a good chunk of, that we have clear evidence of high crimes and misdemeanors by the President of the United States being carried out by his thugs, Alberto Gonzalez and Andrew Card, and being testified to by the guy who was the acting Attorney General of the United States, James Comey. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, I know you've been talking about the Department of Justice, and today the Inspector General and the Office of Professional Responsibility basically said, sent a letter to the Department of Justice, to the Senate Judiciary Committee, saying that they are going to investigate allegations regarding Monica Goodling's hiring practices. They're going to take a look at the summer law intern program, and they're going to take a look at the Civil Rights Division, which, as you know, has not had many African Americans hired there in a very, very long period of time.
So let me get this straight. The Bush administration Department of Justice is telling us, has told Congress, that they are going to investigate themselves. Is that right?
That is correct. Now,
should that reassure us?
Professional responsibility has been something that has not been terribly corrupted, by my point of view, by the political process. They have a lot of career. They have a lot of career people there.
So he hasn't been able to get his political hacks appointed to that particular office.
Well, my view is that when this stuff began to happen in the Senate, they kind of looked at each other and say, "Hey, we're home free, Charlie. We can do what we normally would do."
Who said that about?
The people within the Office of Professional Responsibility. In other words, they've been given sort of a green light by the Senate investigations, knowing that they're not going to be punished for their
being that these people are career investigators within the Justice Department. They're loyal to the Justice Department and to the Constitution, not to George Bush, and they're pleased now that Congress has said to them, okay, you can now lay out some of the crimes that have been committed within your own department.
Well, they're very protected because they know that nobody in the Justice Department at this point is going to come after them, the politicos, because they're really protected by the fact that there are Senate and House investigations.
Right. It would be like firing Archibald Cox.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they now have the political cover to do what they need to do.
So this is good news.
It's very good news.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Thank you, Ellen.
Very, very good news. Also this morning, my friend, and he is my friend, Tony Snow, I'm telling you, they must have writers in the White House that come up with some of these ideas. He said that essentially Iraq would ultimately be similar to South Korea. And he said the Korean model is one in which the United States provides a security presence, but you've had the development essentially of a democracy in South Korea over a period of years, and therefore the United States is a force of stability. Well, it really wasn't South Korea that needed the democracy, as I recall. It was really to protect them from invasion from the North. So, again, they must sit around in those communication meetings and say, now how are we going to spin it? Because
either that or they're smoking something either really good or really bad.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, it's just, this is strange.
A couple other really interesting things I want to sort of mention fast here. And that is, I've looked in the soul of his eyes and I trust him, Putin, is going to be coming to the United States, and they're going to be meeting this time, not at Camp David, not at the Bush Ranch, which Putin has been at twice before, once each, but they're going to be meeting at Bush 41's Kennebunkport Place on July 1 and 2.
Oh, this is interesting. Do you think that this is an attempt by Bush 1 to rein in the insanity of his son?
I am not sure, but I'll tell you, I find that's extremely interesting that they're going there. Either it is really literally because Putin wants to do some sort of, well, I've been to all three places, which often, you know, these guys make a specific request, or Bush 1 is going to be involved. And what we don't know is how much Bush 1 is going to be involved in this.
Now, Putin cracked down a week or so ago. It was the one-year anniversary of the decriminalization of homosexuality in Russia, and there was essentially a small gay rights parade, about 100
people.
Yeah,
we know somebody who sort of got arrested in that, actually.
Yeah, well, and 100 cops showed up and dragged many of them off, including a member of the German parliament, an openly gay member of the German parliament, as I recall. Do you see this as the beginning or an ongoing variation on the Republican strategy in the United States of diverting people's attention away from human rights violations, a sinking economy, and increasing authoritarianism by coming up with villains, in this case gays, just like the Republicans did here?
I'm not sure that the Russians are that. I mean, who's to say they're not that sophisticated? They certainly have been very sophisticated in how they...
Well, the gays were among the first that Hitler went after, you know?
Well, that's... Oh, absolutely, and the pink triangles are from that, and most people don't realize that.
Yeah.
But it's so interesting because it was actually the gay organizations. They were given a fax machine. The gay organization in Moscow, I believe, or maybe it was Leningrad, was given a fax machine, and they actually got out the information during the Yeltsin Revolution.
Oh, that's interesting. So they were at the forefront of progressive change in Russia, not something that Putin would be happy about now.
Exactly. Yeah. So it may be connected to some of that.
That's very interesting.
Hard to say. Last but not least, Mr. Thompson looks like he's going to get in the race over July 4th. And who's he taking or talking to? This Timothy Griffin, who is the political operative of all times and, of course, now is installed as a U.S. attorney in Arkansas.
Tim Griffin
is who's talking. He's talking to Mr. Thompson.
Amazing. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Well, sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Sometimes what you know is not what you don't know. And sometimes what you don't know is what you know. And sometimes everything you know is wrong. You know, as the Firesign Theater said.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be? Is it possible that what we don't know what we don't know about solar power and the possibility of a solar utopia? Harvey Wasserman, the editor at the Free Press, has a new book out. He's also a columnist with Superpower of Peace. It's called Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030. Harvey's done some great work on, for example, the theft of the 2004 election in Ohio. This is solartopia.org, by the way, the website. Harvey, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be with you, Tom.
Harvey, this is quite a different direction from election fraud.
Well, actually not really, because the people who are in power represent the King Kong interest. That's what I call coal, oil, nukes, and gas. And if it wasn't for stolen elections, we'd have had solar power a long time ago. We'd have had a solartopia, because renewable energy can do it all. It can run our society, and it needs to run our society.
Yeah, and in fact, arguably, solar energy does. It's just that it was solar energy that was collected 300 million years ago by plants and stored in the ground, and now we're re-liberating it.
Right,
but,
well,
yeah.
And it needs to stay there, although the worst piece of it is the nuclear part, and you have these psychotic lunatics talking about building new nuclear plants. I mean, why don't they just hand Osama bin Laden some nuclear weapons?
Yeah. The thing I liked the most, well, actually, they already have, you know, Mohammed Atta, this came out in the 9/11 Commission report, had first planned, instead of hitting the World Trade Center, on hitting the Indian Point nuclear reactor, because there's a cooling pond outside where they've got years and years of nuclear waste stored. And if you dove a fully loaded jetliner into that thing, it would render a 100 square mile area, which would include, you know, New York City, uninhabitable for a quarter of a million years. And he finally dismissed that idea as impractical, because he concluded that, you know, it being so dangerous like that, that there had to be surface to air missiles around Indian Point nuclear power plant. And to this day, there aren't.
He was wrong. You know, there is absolutely no way to protect a nuclear power plant from a terrorist attack. It cannot be done. And had he, God forbid, hit the Indian Point nuclear plant instead of the World Trade Centers, we wouldn't be talking about 3,000 people dead. We'd probably be talking about 300,000, with another 3 million, you know, with ongoing cancers. And the United States would never economically recover from a terrorist attack on those nuclear plants.
Right,
we
actually dodged
the bullet.
Yeah, and it's not like you and I, by the way, are right now giving terrorists information they don't have. It was, you know, the New York Times and all the mainstream media that reported that, well, it was the 9/11 Commission that reported that Mohammed Atta had first considered that and then set it aside because he assumed that the nuclear power plant would be well protected, when in fact it wasn't, and it isn't to this day. Go ahead.
I mean, as we're talking, they could be hitting a nuclear plant. There is absolutely nothing, and here these people are talking about building new ones. And, you know, they're shredding our Constitution to protect us from terrorists and giving them pre-deployed weapons of nuclear mass destruction. That's what a nuclear power plant really is.
Yeah, it really is. And one of the things that I really like about your book, we're talking with Harvey Wasserman. He has a new book out, Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth AD 2030, and which isn't that far down the road. I mean, we're talking 23 years.
And it's all doable. It's all economically very, very feasible. Wind power, solar, they're all cheaper than coal, oil, nukes, and gas right now.
What I like most about this book is that, unlike so many books on solar power and solar energy out there that simply deal with the technology and the kind of wonky aspect of it, I mean, there is some dimension of that in your book. You also deal with the politics of it, and the politics of why, from the time when Jimmy Carter said that he was going to have this nation's first solar bank providing 20% of our electricity by the year 2000, and then Reagan came in and stopped that, the politics of the last 26 years that have prevented it from happening.
Yes, and the reality is, if we went to Solartopia now and did nothing but build solar power, we would have an economic boom that would match, you know, the Internet PC boom of the last quarter century. I mean, there are trillions of dollars to be made in alternative energy, and that's the bottom line. That's why I'm so optimistic. Everybody wonders how I can be so optimistic, aside from the fact that it's genetic. I looked at the numbers. And to get to Solartopia, all you have to do is look at the numbers, and you see what really is cheap and what works, and it's all green energy. That's the reality.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And here's in fact, Jimmy Carter on this topic.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
Now, if he had done that, we would not be importing oil from the Middle East. Why did that not happen?
We would not, because Ronald Reagan came in the White House. We had working solar water heating panels on the White House roof. They worked. They were energy saving. Nothing in the world wrong with them. Ronald Reagan comes in and rips him off the White House for no explanation, pitches him in some warehouse. I mean, talk about a Luddite. And, you know, we had tens of thousands of people in 1980 working in the solar energy industry, and Reagan just came in and on behalf of the coal, oil, nuke, and gas industries just tore it apart. And why we're in Iraq, frankly.
Yeah, one of the things that concerns me most is that now there is a major campaign by the coal industry in the United States to convince us that coal can, they're actually accurate in saying this, that coal can be converted into a liquid fuel. I mean, the Nazis did this. They created gasoline out of coal because they had a lot of coal. They had no oil. And that the use of coal as a liquid fuel, we have a lot of coal. You know, we've got a couple of centuries worth of coal here still in the ground in the United States. But doing so without the technology to sequester the carbon emitted from it is going to be devastating in terms of global warming. How do you promote solar energy in an environment where you've got a multi-hundred-billion-dollar industry, you know, arguably a trillion-dollar industry in terms of net worth worldwide, that is laying out, you know, massive advertising campaigns, and not just their advertising campaign's ability to persuade the public, but their advertising campaign's ability to persuade the media on which they are advertising that media should not do investigative reporting revealing what's going on with this industry, and that maybe they should even do some fluff pieces about how wonderful the industry is. After all, they're getting millions of dollars in ad revenue from them.
Right. Well, coal sequestration, even if it did work, is not economical. There's really no reason to do it. There's no reason to mine coal at this point in time because solar, wind, biofuels, geothermal, they're all much cheaper and much more efficient and also much more job-producing. So Solartopia is an economic vision. It's not a utopian vision at all. And you have the big barriers, and I deal with this in Solartopia, is the structure of the corporation. And you've written tremendously about this. In fact, one of my initial sources is that the structure of the corporate charters in our country allows corporations to have human rights but not human responsibilities. And so these companies are selling this ridiculous, obsolete, I call them a 20th century pox, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, and they are obsolete. They don't work. They're not economical. And so they're staying in the way of perhaps the greatest industrial revolution or post-industrial revolution that we've ever known, and that's the Solartopian revolution. And I think we'll get through it because our survival depends on it. I mean, we do have a survival instinct. Well, aside from the crashing economy, we will not be able to live on this planet if they keep burning coal and building nuclear plants. And that's the bottom line. And that's why I think it'll be done by 2030, because that's about as far as I see the carrying capacity of our Earth in this paradigm.
Well, we're seeing new reports now that we have fewer than 10 years before we hit a tipping point where global warming flips over into a positive feedback loop. And there's just at that point, there's nothing we can do.
Right. Well, we're gonna have to find it because you know, people do want to survive. We do have a survival instinct. The dumbest thing is to build new nuclear plants. That's completely insane. And anybody, as far as I'm concerned, when I hear somebody talking about building new nukes, I look for people in the white coats to come pick them up. You know, it's just ridiculous.
Well, Helen Caldicott points out that a nuclear power plant doesn't start producing its first watt of actual nuclear electricity for about 12 to 15 years, because it takes that long to pay back all the fossil fuels that go into building the thing, mining the uranium, refining the uranium, transporting the uranium, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's so much fossil fuel in a nuclear plant. It's almost a pass-through. But,
yeah, nuclear plants are major contributors to global warming. And,
yeah,
you know, they're telling this lie that they're carbon emission-free. It's false.
Yeah, it's absolutely false. Harvey Wasserman, he's the senior editor over at thefreepress.org, and Solartopia is his new book, Our Green-Powered Earth, AD 2030, solartopia.org, the website for that. Harvey, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks, Tom. You're terrific.
Keep up the great work yourself. 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Something to bless or to blame.
a chance. I've always been crazy. It's kept me from going insane.
Yeah, your island of rationality here, the Tom Hartman Program. 21 minutes past the hour, fair and slightly unbalanced. Larry Scott's with us. He's the chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org. Keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to.
That's
hey, Larry.
Right. Hi, Tom. Hey, who's unbalanced? You or me? I didn't.
Yeah, I did. There you go. It kind of goes around, you know.
Okay.
The VA is going to notify veterans of possible medical expense reimbursement in compensation award. Like what? Tell me about this.
This is a very interesting story, and you and I have talked before that the VA is under no obligation to tell veterans about their benefits. Okay, they just don't. What you have to do as a veteran, you have to go to the VA and say, I need my benefits, and I would like, is this a benefit? Can I get this benefit? Well, what happens when a veteran files a claim for a disability? That claim process could take a year or more to what they call adjudicate. Perhaps it's an injury they sustained while on active duty. During that year time, the veteran could have, obviously, medical expenses related to that injury. Could have medications, doctor visits, and so forth. What most veterans don't know is that medical expenses they incur from the time they file the claim until their disability compensation is awarded, those medical expenses can be reimbursed. But the VA, in their wisdom, has never bothered to tell veterans about this. So Senator Daniel Akaka, who is chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, wrote a letter to VA Secretary Jim Nicholson and said, I really think it would be a polite thing to do to let veterans know they can get these expenses reimbursed, and they put pressure on the VA, and the VA has now agreed to inform veterans that when they receive their VA compensation award, they will be notified that they can get these expenses reimbursed. It's really a great move because the VA will go back and help pay those expenses, and it saves the veteran a lot of out-of-pocket money.
But it's really a great move that had to be shoved down the throat of the Republican political hack, Jim Nicholson, who is the head of the VA, appointed by George W. Bush, primarily because he was very successful as a Republican fundraiser.
Exactly right, Tom. And Nicholson is exactly that. He is a political hack, and this did have to be shoved down his throat. What we're finding now, with Democratic control of the House and Senate, and that means obviously of the Senate and the House Veterans Affairs Committees as well, we're finding a lot of these little loose ends being picked up and being taken care of, these things that have kind of fallen by the wayside over the years. The VA is finally saying, okay, we'll do that. Yes, we'll do that. We'll notify veterans, and we will help here. And a lot of praise should go to Senator Akaka of Hawaii and Bob Filner, the congressman from California, who chairs the House committee, for getting a lot of this work done and really putting the VA in a position of where they are helping veterans more now. But they had to be forced to do it. You're absolutely right.
And on the other hand, they're still able to play politics with the Veterans Administration. For example, this release of the new outpatient clinics list.
Right. Well, the VA had, and these clinics are based on need around the country, 38 new outpatient clinics around the country. This list was made up some time ago. The VA withheld the list. They never released it to the public, but what they did was they released the information just before Memorial Day to the politicians in whose districts these clinics would be built. So all of a sudden we see articles popping up all over the internet saying, Congressman so-and-so, I helped get a VA clinic for this area. And I went looking and I said, how do all these people have this? This list should be public information. The list was finally released yesterday by the VA, so we know where all 38 of these clinics are going to be built. But what they had done is they played politics with this information. They gave it to the politicians a couple days prior to the Memorial Day weekend so they could get press in their local newspapers or on radio or on television and claim that this was a great victory for them, that they had helped bring the clinic to the area, when basically the clinics are based on need and the number of veterans living in an area. And also, we're doing a breakdown on this list, but what we've come up with so far is the majority of these clinics were placed in districts where, you can guess, can't you?
Drum roll. Yeah. Boom.
Republican congressman.
Right.
Happened right now.
And this is supposed to be based on need. Is it just a coincidence that those districts that are represented by Republicans are the most in need?
We're not sure right now. I'm working with a gentleman who's a former VA employee who's a statistics whiz. And what he's doing is he's going back and he's looking at the number of veterans in the area. He's putting together a whole database on this. And within the next 3 or 4 days, we should have an analysis of whether these clinics were actually needed in those areas or whether they were placed there for political gain. We'll have more on that coming up, I would say, probably by the end of this week or early next week.
Okay, and in 20, 30 seconds before we have to wrap this up, any other points you want to make about what's going on with the VA, Larry?
Well, just that the VA did, and although it was really a hard way to do it, the VA did benefit from the war funding bill. It got $1.78 billion in immediate influx of cash, much of that going for programs for veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. It was kind of a hard way to get that money, but it's good that that money is there for veterans, Tom.
Yeah. Okay. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody has to. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you again, Tom.
Always good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. More news of the day and your calls right after this. Stick around. Here's your opportunity to listen carefully and support listener-supported radio by patronizing our sponsors.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your ears. The president kicked democracy out the door and he shipped it. Giving birth instead to a holy war. I don't know why those Iraqis got so sore. We only killed 100,000 or more. It's called collateral damage when you're waging a war.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman radio program supported by you, supporting our sponsors and our local radio stations, as well as our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee at sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics at smalldog.com, and the Organic Wine Company at ecowine.com. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Janice in Seattle on the line. Hey, Janice.
Hi. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
It's regarding Solartopia.
Mm-hmm.
For my son's science fair project this year, he made three small solar cells. Mm-hmm. And he used raspberries and spinach and synthetic dye.
Really?
And they all worked.
That's incredible.
And that they measured, like, voltage and current.
Sure, sure.
And
yeah, there's a...
It was cool. It was really
yeah.
neat. But
yeah.
then he asked, why can't we use, like, grass or
mm-hmm.
something else from the garden
yeah.
to dye the cells? And,
well, that's a good...
And why aren't more people in the solar energy industry exploring this concept?
Yeah. My guess would be that there are other ways of doing it, like the rare earth metals, that are more efficient, but they may be far more expensive. I don't know. It's a very interesting one. Well, you've tossed out on the airwaves there. Maybe there's a solar engineer out there who's listening, and they'll pick up
well,
the challenge.
Well, I hope so, because, you know, I mean, it was really cool. I mean, we just took raspberries, frozen raspberries,
mm-hmm.
and yeah. they worked.
Yeah, well, that's
you know,
great. Janice.
Measured current and voltage.
Yep. Thank you so much for the call and the heads up, and you know, we'll see what goes wrong, what, you know, where that goes. Karen in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Karen.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to add a point for the argument for a solar utopia. It's not just security because it plants are targets for terrorists or economic efficiency, but, of course, it's also the horrible nuclear pollution. And as you know, we're close to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, which is up in Washington, and it's the most polluted site in the Western Hemisphere, and it also pollutes the Columbia River groundwater. I was on the Columbia Riverkeeper Board for a while, so I learned these things. And also, one other thing concerning social responsibility, the Network of Spiritual Progressives advocates a social responsibility amendment to the Constitution. I'm a member of that group, and I think that's a really good idea. So I think that in terms of corporations not having an onus of social responsibility, we need an amendment to the Constitution.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, every state constitution up until late 1890s, I'd say, was probably the end of the charter mongering era. But up until the 1880s, every state constitution required the corporations as their first responsibility, actually right into their charters, that their first responsibility was to serve the public good. And then you know, when Ohio in 1880, whatever year it was, 84, I think it was, or 89, I forget the year now, but it was in the 1880s, Ohio said to John Rockefeller, what you're doing is illegal. You can't do that here. It's against state law. It's against our state antitrust laws, and you're not working in the public good with your Standard Oil Trust of Ohio. And John Rockefeller said, okay. And it was illegal in every state in the union. And he said, okay, whatever state I move to is going to see an enormous amount of money coming from the tax dollars that I'm generating and from all the economic activity that I'm generating. So what state wants to change their rules? And so New Jersey said, well, we will. And then New York said, well, we will. And then Connecticut said, well, we'll do even better. And then New Jersey said, well, we'll do better than that. And finally, Delaware said, oh, we'll do better than any of you guys. Well, by that time, he'd actually moved to New Jersey because they were fixing to throw him in jail in Ohio. But Delaware has the least restrictive corporate laws, which is why the majority of the Fortune 500 companies, the majority of the companies listed on the Dow Jones big board, are the top companies, are all New Jersey corporations, this charter-mongering thing of the late 1800s. Anyhow, Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick.
Yes, Tom. I don't know if you touched on or were aware of this article that Gingrich wrote for The New Yorker.
I have not read it. I printed it out yesterday, and I intended to read it. It's I understand the essence of it is that he's basically trying to he's acknowledging that Bush and Rove have destroyed the Republican Party, and he's trying to lay the blame on Bush and Rove rather than on Republican policies and conservative ideology.
Well, worse than that, he's actually comparing it to the Carter administration, which the Republicans have been beating up on for years. But I wonder what your opinion was on this. How do you think the right-wing media will play this? Will they take one side or the other, or will they just ignore it?
I suspect that the conservative media is really, most of it, is actually not really conservative media. It's actually Republican media. You know, Faux News, for example, is the propaganda arm of the Republican Party. And so the only salvation for the Republican Party is to get itself out from under and away from George W. Bush as fast as possible.
Yeah.
And so my guess is that they will embrace Gingrich's position. Gingrich, of course, is even considering positioning himself for a presidential run.
Oh, sure, that's what this is all about. And I think that, and I think on the immigration issue, whichever side you're on, the right wing is basically, maybe they're just using it as an excuse, but they're really trashing Bush on this immigration bill.
Oh, sure. They're going to be trashing Bush on all kinds of things. I mean, this is just the beginning of it, Rick. It's going to be ongoing because he's, I mean, you know what? The 32% popularity, 28%. It's a, you know, how low can you go? Well, Cheney's 13%. I mean, everybody in the Republican Party politically realizes that they have to turn and run as far away and as fast away as they can from these guys. But good point. Thanks for bringing it up, Rick. Freeman in San Diego, California. Hey, Freeman.
Hey, Tom. I got a devil's advocate side to play on the solar panel versus nuclear power plant.
Sure.
You said it takes 15 years or so for the nuclear power plant to generate its first watt. How long does it take for solar?
My understanding is that it's within 2 years.
Is that quick?
And yeah, it's actually because they're not complex things. I mean, a nuclear power plant is this huge, heavy, clunky thing,
sure.
and you've got to then go out and find uranium under the ground, and then you've got to dig down into the ground with giant earth-moving machines and pull it out, and then you've got to build an entire complex of centrifuges to spin the stuff, because typically, you know, uranium comes out at about 0.3%, as I recall, or 0.5% purity, and you've got to refine it to the point where it's at least 3 to 3.5% pure in order to make nuclear fuel out of it. And you do that in these giant, this is what Iran is doing right now. You do this
right.
In these giant complexes of centrifuges. All of these things are powered by electricity or directly by gasoline or fuel oil. And whereas solar panels, you know, it's a technology like making the LCD screen for your computer. It's not, there's not that much that goes into it. It's not all that fancy or sophisticated.
I wonder why it's so expensive then, because I was looking to put solar panels in my house and it just didn't make financial sense because it would take years and years to make back the money.
Well, it takes about 7 years right now, is my understanding, is the payback on solar power, you know, versus electricity, although it varies where you are in the country. You know, in California, it's a lot cheaper because you can get tax benefits. And depending on what your local utility rates are and depending on whether or not your local utility will buy back surplus power and you can put the things on the grid or whether you have to use batteries for storage. If you can get it on the grid and basically use the grid as your storage system, it becomes a whole lot less expensive. I think that and then there's economies of scale, you know, manufacturing. I mean, Germany is consuming these things like crazy,
sure,
which is driving up the cost of them. I think it's just going to be a matter of time. I mean, look at how expensive computers were when they first came out.
Right.
And, you know, 3,000, I remember TRS-80, Model 3 computer, Model 2 computer, the first business computer from Radio Shack and IBM's early computer, $2,000-$3,000 for 64K.
I used the Trash 80.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I programmed in BASIC on TRS-80 Model 3. And then we got a 2 later for a bookkeeping program, actually, for this Community for Abused Kids that we were running in New Hampshire in the early 1980s, late 70s. And you just look at how far and how fast it's come. I think, you know, solar technology, well, I don't think. You just look at it. Solar technology is moving that fast. Nuclear technology, on the other hand, can only exist if we all subsidize it.
Right.
It's the Price-Anderson Act is the only thing that allows nuclear energy to even exist in the United States because it is so dangerous, it is uninsurable. The waste is so dangerous, the technology itself is it's uninsurable. If they took, and the nuclear industry acknowledges this, if you take away Price-Anderson, which says that you and I are the ones who are insuring the nuclear industry, we are fully responsible if anything goes wrong. If you took away Price-Anderson and said to the nuclear industry, okay, you guys, you're going to have to buy your insurance from Travelers or from, you know, Allstate or whatever, actually it would be, you know, like Swiss Re, you know, one of the big insurance companies, they couldn't afford it. It would make nuclear power absolutely unaffordable. And you don't have that problem with solar energy. So, that's clearly solar energy the direction to go. Justin in Woodland Hills, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Justin, got about a minute before we got to take a break. What's up?
Just want to call and thank you for, basically everything you do. You know, I consider you the professor. I've been listening to you since you were on day one here in K-Talk, and I listen every day. And I really want to say thanks for bringing up that Call Me testimony. I actually missed that. And, you know, but if you were to combine the Call Me testimony with what Monica Goodling said about the caging and voter fraud and then what they're trying to do with the wiretap program, I mean, that is clearly impeachable offenses. And I wish one of our congressmen or one of our senators would catch on to this and say, hey, wait a second, we need to do something about this because the evidence is clearly there.
Yeah, this is all, as John Dean says, worse than Watergate. The problem is the average American doesn't know. And the average American doesn't know because, in my opinion, because up to this point, the interests of large corporate media, particularly the television media in the United States, are pretty much the same as the interests of the Republican Party.
It is. And I don't know if you caught, just really quick, if you caught on MSNBC last night, Al Gore talking about the very same thing with Keith Olbermann. It was pretty brilliant as far as what he was saying about how they're bending the message to...
Finish your sentence, Justin. Yeah. Oh, I guess Justin's gone. But, yeah, they're bending the... Exactly. And at the same time that Al Gore is talking about that, CNN is hiring a new reporter to report on what? On Britney Spears, a new entertainment reporter. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Tell me, George, if there's any damn way that there'll ever be a day I can get on a plane without worrying about the next maniac trying to pay me back just 'cause you're half insane. Right-wing freak judges, $200 billion grudges. Yes, war's cooked up right from day one. Big corporations are running this nation like it never was meant to be run. Yes, George, I hope you're having fun.
Well, tragically, I suspect he is. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. Say hi in our live chat room if you'd like. And Gary in Westchester, New York. Hey, Gary.
Hey, Tom. First, I want to really thank you for your well-reasoned and non-hysterical dialogue every day. It's about time people had open discussions and free exchange of information without all the hyperbole, so thank you very much.
You're welcome.
About nuclear. I've been involved. I live 6 miles from the Indian Point nuclear plant. I've been involved in this issue for a good number of years since the Indian Point nuclear plant burst a pipe and released radioactive steam into the atmosphere, and I thought maybe I should learn a little more about this issue. And you mentioned the Price-Anderson Act, which caps liability for the entire industry, but consumers should understand that if the ultimate arbiter of risk, if the insurance industry is the ultimate arbiter of risk, they should understand that no matter how big a premium you wanted to pay, you cannot insure your home against radiological contamination. So that should underscore just how risky these nuclear plants all are.
You mean if unlike you, I don't live near a nuclear power plant, at least not that I know of. The one here near Portland was decommissioned a while ago. So if I lived near a nuclear power plant like you do, and I went to my insurance company and I said, you know, I realize the insurance company, the nuclear power plant can't get insurance, but I'd like to get insurance against their having a nuclear accident. The insurance company would say to me, we will not sell it to you.
No insurance company will insure private property against radiological contamination, which should let everybody know just how large the potential risk really is. And I also want to point out that, you know, there's this whole myth about nuclear being a clean and green technology. And people should also understand that when the yellow cake gets, as you were mentioning a few minutes ago, that when the yellow cake gets mined out of the ground, it has to be upgraded to become fuel grade. And most uranium plants have large fossil fuel electric plants attached to them because it requires a huge amount of electricity to turn the yellow cake into fuel grade uranium pellets. So any nuclear plant starts out with a huge carbon debt before they ever produce a single megawatt of energy.
That's Helen Caldicott's point.
Right. And she's fabulous, as is Harvey. You know, they're both great. And you know, ultimately, if we're really talking about moving away from fossil fuels to renewables, remember that uranium is not an infinite source. It's a finite material, and there are estimates that within the next 50 years, all of the yellow cake would be expended to begin.
Right. We may well have hit peak uranium in the world, interestingly enough. And the price of it has been going up quite steadily. It's been almost following the price of oil over the last decade or so. It's fascinating to watch.
Yeah. License renewal. Everybody should understand that when nuclear plants go online in this country, they were originally issued 40-year operating licenses. Many of those licenses are expiring within the near future, and that relicensing standards by the NRC do not take into account any of the current standards for siting a nuclear plant. So many that exist right now, especially the one near me, which is 35 miles from Midtown Manhattan, could never be built today, and that the NRC is really an enabler rather than a regulator. And there's an inherent conflict of interest, because if they shut nuclear plants, their jobs go away. So the NRC is really doing an inadequate job of regulating these things.
Well, and it's always pretty much been that way. I mean, the whole nuclear power industry, my understanding of it is that it came about in large part out of a bunch of scientists who felt incredibly guilty at having devised the most lethal bomb in history and vaporizing a couple hundred thousand human beings. And so they were trying to, you know, make some lemonade out of that lemon. They were trying to come up with some positive outcome from the development of nuclear technology. And they said, well, maybe we can make electricity with this and redeem ourselves.
Right. And back then people were talking about it would be too cheap to even meter the electricity.
Yeah, no, I remember my friend Terry's dad actually converted his house to all electric in the early 60s when we were kids in elementary school, because he was convinced that it was going to be free energy. So why have, gas power and like that? Yeah, good point. Gary, thank you very much for the call and the heads up. George Ann in Portland, Oregon. Hey, George Ann, got about a minute here before we have to wrap up this hour.
Thanks. Tom, I wanted to say, I happen to be a psychotherapist, and people throw around the term sociopath. And I think that it's not very well understood. It's sort of understood to be a kind of an epithet, but it's really a diagnosis. And the diagnosis indicates a way that a mind works. And people that are sociopaths are really not constrained by what normal people are constrained by, which is conscience. And you can imagine what it would be like if you didn't have a conscience. If you actually didn't have one, then
well, it actually even goes beyond a step beyond that, because sociopaths don't view everybody else as being fully human. They, can,
they
consider themselves
them
the only person
fully human, and which also allows them to not take them into account. So we have a Katrina,
right.
We have, you know, the shift of capital to corporations. We have globalism. We have
I get it, and I'm right there with you. And we have essentially sociopathic corporations, in a way a sociopathic government, and I would argue that we have a sociopath as our president right at the moment. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be debating conservative Brink Lindsey on how prosperity transformed America's politics and culture. Kathleen Kennedy Townsend is dropping by, as well as Joan MacArthur. That and your calls in the news. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.